Good evening, and thanks for joining us on The Week in Review. I'm Brandis Friedman in for Nick Blumberg. Two independent congressional candidates are booted off the ballot, thinning out the competition to take over Congressman Chuy Garcia's seat.
Democracy died yesterday in the 4th Congressional District.
It's very clear that Patty doesn't think she can win this election at the ballot box.
Byron Sigcho-Lopez and Myra Macias accuse Patty Garcia's campaign and the Illinois State Board of Elections of unfair treatment after a review found they did not secure enough valid petition signatures.
Where are these so-called housing providers for the people in crisis?
Making it more burdensome for us to run our buildings only increases the cost of housing.
The battle over renters' protections heats up as two competing proposals work their way through City Hall.
We urge all Americans to follow CDC guidance on properly washing and cooking raw ingredients to prevent this foodborne illness.
The number of confirmed cyclosporiasis cases ticks up as public health officials continue to look for the outbreak's source.
This crisis is a manufactured crisis. It is a crisis that has happened because of a structural deficit that political leaders have not had the courage to address.
Chicago Public Schools faces a $732 million budget shortfall and possibly hundreds of layoffs for teachers and support staff. Plus, six Cook County residents die of factors relating to extreme heat in the deadliest July in over a decade. And Illinois prepares to commemorate its first Emmett Till Day in memory of the 14-year-old Chicago boy whose murder galvanized the civil rights movement.
And now to our Week in Review panel. Joining us are Monica Ng of Axios, Sarah Karp of WBEZ, Rufus Williams of WVON, and Melody Mercado of Block Club Chicago. Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's start with the lettuce. Monica, this morning, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention added Illinois to the multi-state outbreak investigation of cyclosporiasis linked to iceberg lettuce. As of yesterday, Illinois has 513 confirmed and probable cases of cyclosporiasis, 112 of which are in Chicago. What happens to people who are infected?
Well, two words, explosive diarrhea.
Fun.
And you heard it here first. I think it happened in my house.
Oh, dear.
You think?
Well, luckily, it has not spread person to person.
Right. This is a few weeks ago. It's terrible. And actually, 28 people were hospitalized in Illinois. So it's no laughing matter, actually. Michigan's got like thousands of cases. And yet, they still have not found the smoking gun or the smoking lettuce leaf, unless it is the Taylor Farms iceberg lettuce that went to Taco Bell. But at this point, they're still looking for the source of this much bigger outbreak than we've seen in previous years.
Right. It's also kind of hard to sort of like test it, right? Like, you know, you like once you've been infected, you don't really know what's going on with your body for a couple of days.
Right. Well, up to a month, I believe, I can incubate. And, you know, frankly, let's say it was in our house. Maybe it was. We didn't go and say, let's sign up and have it tested. So they believe there could be thousands more. This could be, you know, many factors larger than they're actually seeing in confirmed cases.
What are you all doing to avoid this? Melody, Sarah, Rufus?
I'm not eating lettuce. I mean, they said that it takes 2 weeks to know whether or not they're asking people what they did in the last 2 weeks. And I don't know how many of us are keeping track of what we did 2 weeks ago, but I do find myself eating a lot fewer salads and a lot less lettuce at this time, and raspberries.
I do tend to shop locally at the farmer's market for my produce, which has been, you know, suggestion for, you know, avoiding big box retail lettuce in general. But yeah, I have also been eating less salads. I'm not totally upset about that, but you know, whatever we can do to stay safe and use this opportunity to shop local.
Sarah.
I don't know. I'm being risky. I like iceberg lettuce, but I usually buy it in, you know, already like just a full head of lettuce
versus a bag of lettuce.
And I think that that's been okay. I mean, so far so good. I do like a salad. I don't know.
I love a good salad. I had a salad yesterday and one the day before, you guys, so.
And I'm growing we'll my see. Own I'm growing my own romaine and raspberries, so I'm safe.
But I want to be her.
Come over to my house. I'll give you some of my homegrown.
Everybody, Monica's house.
And our readers did tell us that they're eating a lot fewer salads.
How is this outbreak? Is this different or worse than previous ones, Monica?
Much worse, which is, we usually see it in the spring and the summer, but not in these numbers. And that's why it is so vexing that they can't find the source. And I should say FDA has fewer resources to do that.
Okay. We also experienced waves of extreme heat this month. It has since cooled down. I got out for a walk today. It was a little cool. I could have taken a hoodie. But six people in Cook County have died from heat-related deaths this July, making it the deadliest July in a decade for that reason. Five out of six of those people, though, who died, Rufus, lived on Chicago's South and West Sides. Why might communities on the South and West Sides be more susceptible to heat-related illness?
Well, it all has to do with affordability, doesn't it? It matters whether or not you can pay your utility bill. It matters whether or not you live in a place that has air conditioning. It matters when it gets that warm. And, you know, we're now in a space where loneliness is a problem. And people who are disconnected, nobody's checking on them, no one's making certain that they have all the things that they need. And this is particularly acute on the South and West Sides of Chicago, which is where we're seeing it. We're always reminded of what took place in 1995. When we lost so many people due to this heat wave. So it's good that it's cooling down. I was in Dallas last weekend, came back on Tuesday. The temperature was 106 degrees when I was in Dallas. And so to get off the plane, and I had to put on a jacket, it felt cold when I got here. So it's good that it's gone, it's good the smoke has blown over. But that is one that we pay particular attention to in July in Chicago because of what happened in 1995.
Right. And you talk about affordability, and not everyone can afford, you know, to crank the AC to cool themselves down if they have it.
Right, even if they have it.
Right. Sarah, like when you hear that five out of six people die, I mean, does that surprise you, especially knowing, you know, all the efforts that folks take post-1995?
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me because people right now, there's a lot of people can't pay their bills for a lot of basic necessities. And so if you look at, I mean, even I look at my air conditioner, I'm like, do we have to have it on this high? It's going to be really expensive. And then there's the issue of what are the cooling places and whether those cooling places should stay open longer. You know, where is the library that you can go sit in? Or, you know, I know they
can
say
you get to the library.
Right, can you get to the library? I know they say that you can go to a police station and sit there, but I don't know.
Really?
If I really want to go sit at a police station. I might want to stay in my stinking hot house, but
not my first choice.
I can assure you the people on the South and West Side do not want to go sit at a
police station. That is not the first thing that comes to mind. Let's go to the police station.
One of the interesting things, though, when I was in Dallas, you may recall the World Cup.
And
they
heard
played games there, and people were really infatuated with the fact that there was air conditioning because a lot of the places they were coming from don't have air conditioning. Mm-hmm. This was a real big boon.
Yeah, even in some very well-developed nations in Europe, that is, air conditioning is not a thing for them the way it is for us to just have it. They just have to find other ways to adjust. So two competing renters ordinances, they're making their way through the city council, Melody. What do we know about these bills?
We know that one was drafted by the mayor's office and the other was drafted by the group known as the Budget Accountability Coalition. If you're familiar with that group, they're the folks that passed their own alternative spending plan instead of going with Mayor Brandon Johnson's plan. The plans are somewhat similar. The major differences is that Mayor Johnson's plan is more progressive and has some more protections for renters, such as just cause eviction, which means that you can't evict someone just because you don't want to renew their lease. You have to have some very specific reasons for that, and then it would require relocation assistance if somebody were to not to be evicted through no fault of their own. For example, maybe the landlord wanted to renovate the space or was selling the unit, then the renter would be eligible for several thousand dollars of relocation assistance. The FAIR ordinance, which is being put on by this alternative group, pretty much nixes all of the mayor's a little more progressive policies geared towards renters' protections, because they believe that if the Mayor Johnson's ordinance were to pass, that it would lead to landlords passing down the cost to renters in the forms of being more stingy with who they rent to, in addition to having to raise rent if they have to have a backlog of several thousands of dollars to be able to relocate somebody.
Okay. This seems to me, Monica, like another example of city council doing its own thing. How has the mayor responded to this sort of alt proposal?
Well, he said, you know, basically they copied and pasted 98% of my ordinance and then, you know, took out these important protections. And there are a lot of similarities, although the fair proposal also has these incentives for people who take currently unused space and turn it into housing. But, you know, there were some things written into the fair ordinance which seemed to roll back current protections for renters. And both Gil Villegas and Nicole Lee, who were some of the main sponsors, said none of that was intentional. Our intention is only to strengthen renters' protections. So we are, this is a starting point, and we will see this evolve, but we never want to propose anything that actually rolls back any current protections. And so, you know, they're on the record, so people should either take them at their word or, you know, see if that actually happens.
Okay, so another turn of events in the congressional race, this one, the race to replace longtime Congressman Jesus Chuy Garcia, of course. Two of the independent candidates were booted off the ballot after a review found that they didn't submit enough valid petition signatures. Monica, how did those two respond?
They were not happy about it. There actually might be a challenge on it. And I think this, a lot of people don't understand the mechanics of these kinds of independent candidates. I didn't realize that they needed 11,000 signatures to get on the ballot, whereas the major party candidate needed 750-something. That seems a little weighted towards the
in favor existing, of the party candidate.
Yeah, and so it felt a little machiny. But, you know, the Board of Elections said, look, we wanted to help you. You needed this many. You simply didn't. I think they were short by less than 2,000 each.
Melody, they're also saying that these challenges were a targeted attack. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think everybody's kind of looking back at the history events of this and how Congressman Garcia chose to drop out and magically his chief of staff, Patty Garcia, no relation, all of a sudden had signatures ready to turn in to be on the ballot and left these independent candidates sort of, you know, in the wind when it comes to trying to, you know, get their names on the ballot. And so I think people are really asking themselves, man, is this really the legend, the history that Congressman Garcia really wants to leave behind? Is this what he wants to be remembered by? And it's leaving a bad taste in people's mouths.
Rufus, what do you think this means for Patty Garcia? She's the Democrat on the ticket, as we mentioned, of course, former chief of staff for Chuy.
I mean, she's likely the winner, and then people will go to her just as they do for constituent services and everything else. But I can tell you, and having spoken directly with Myra, she was a big supporter of Chuy's and felt really bad, one, in the way in which it happened, that he dropped out and Patty was ready. And then this just makes it even worse with the challenges to their petitions when they were looking to really try and bring forth a democratic process, and this appears to be pushing further and further away from democracy.
There's also something to be said, I think, about the name recognition, right? They share the same last name, no relation necessarily, but if voters are kind of like not that informed and just bothered not to to look around and see who else is running, does she also have, you know, sort of an advantage there, unintended, you know?
I mean, she can't change her name, but I mean, I think it's pretty clear in Illinois, in Cook County, she's likely to be the winner, regardless, yeah.
So in the school board race, Chicago's first fully elected school board race, Sarah, that's shaping up to be an expensive one. Your reporting is showing that candidates have raised more than $1.8 million. Where's that money coming from? Where's it going?
So the big one is that Victor Henderson, who's a candidate for the president of the school board, who is not really a very known figure on the education scene. He's an attorney, he's on Urban Prep Charter Schools Board, but besides that, hasn't done that much in the education realm. He donated $500,000 to his own campaign, he loaned it. So that boosted everybody and it blew the spending limit. So now anybody can donate anything to school board candidates. Also, some of the other school board candidates have raised pretty significant amounts. Most of the people down ballot have not raised all that much, but One really interesting thing when you talk about the petitions, you know, now we have four races that are uncontested, two of which because the candidates that were the opposing candidates, the non-incumbent candidates, were thrown off the ballots. And that was through ballot challenges. And so it's kind of interesting, you know, where, and there's still many more that have to be ruled on by the Chicago Board of Elections. So.
Go ahead, Rufus.
Yeah, I say this is just interesting that we come a lot to talk about the elections around our schools, given all the other issues that we have within our schools. But this is really where the focus is, and the focus will be because we now have an elected school board and 21 people being elected. You know, these things become exciting at the very beginning, and we'll see as time goes along how much the interest will still be, because these are not truly not easy jobs to do the job.
And they're unpaid.
Well,
I mean, actually, the thing is that not as many people as we thought entered the race. I mean, there are two races in which they nobody else entered besides the incumbent. And the interesting thing is what I would ask sort of the players, why didn't you enter people into that race? And they said, we have had a really hard time finding people who can do this because it's an unpaid job and it's so much time. I mean, I can't imagine why somebody would want to do this.
It's kind of like the LSC, the local school council elections, right? You know, that was something that was a big deal at the time, was it not? And there are elections that happen. Sometimes do the communities around the schools even know that the LSC election is happening or that there are positions open that need to be filled? I think it was another one of those things. Once the novelty wore off of having achieved the thing you wanted, is everybody still that interested in running and doing the work when the time for that comes? Sarah, the board president's race, though, has become a focal point for fundraising. Why is that?
Well, it's the biggest one. It's the citywide election. And one thing that we've sort of learned over the last 2 years is the power held at the board president level. Because what is happening now is that that board president is the one responsible for making the agenda for the school board meetings. And so if anybody wants to put something in front, they really have to go through that board president. And so now that some of the people who, Jennifer Custer and Jessica Biggs, who are on the school board, they decided they did not want to run for their district seats because they found, I think, that they don't have as much power as they would like to really affect things, and they're running for school board president. And so I just think there's this recognition that this is really a very powerful position.
Yeah, also, it is the position you're running for that one citywide versus in a much smaller district. You're going to need more money to wage a citywide campaign.
For sure.
Rufus, what do you think voters should be watching out for over the next few months as we get closer to the election?
Well, one, I think it's fascinating to hear about the power of the position that I once held. So it's just interesting.
The mayor also had some power, and this person is independent of the mayor.
Yeah, independent of everyone, which also begs the question of who's in charge now, because you've got 21 people who are there coming from all these different places. So when something goes astray, who is in charge? What's in charge? What are you looking at? In all of these different races, I think in every case, people in each district, as Chicago is, segregated, rich, poor, whatever, will be looking out for what's best for their constituents. But when you get to the board, it's a bigger discussion about what happens in the best interest of all in the city. And that's really where the school board president has to kind of keep these things in order and see what's the best for the most, irrespective of who's asking for all, and how do you get to some parity in those places.
And whoever gets elected, they're also going to have to deal with a district that is struggling financially, because the Board of Education scheduled to vote July 30th on CPS's proposed $9.88 billion budget. They, of course, Sarah, they don't have to pass that budget until August. So it sounds like they've got a little bit of time in case this doesn't go well next week. But what are the cuts there that they're looking at?
Well, one thing that I have to say is that CPS officials are pressuring the board to pass the budget on July 30th. They say, and this is very unprecedented, that CPS will not be able to pay payroll in September if they do not get the budget passed on July 30th, because you know, there's been delays in the Cook County property tax, and there's some money that CPS says the Cook County still owes them from April's installment. And so CPS needs to take a short-term loan. They take short-term loans all the time to make payroll. And I don't exactly understand why it is, but the CPS officials are very, very insistent that they must get this budget passed next week. And this is a budget that it's it has deep cuts. About 760 teachers got layoff notices a week ago. About 801 classroom aides got layoff notices. There are countless other probably people who have gotten layoff notices. You know, some of the things like security guards and tutors and interventionists, and there's a lot of other staff that we don't really talk about that much, that we don't really have. One thing that's driving me a little nuts, and maybe this will happen pretty soon, but they haven't put out school level information yet, which usually they do well before now, and I'm pretty upset about this. But let me just say,
I've been asking for it,
but here's the thing, like, we do not really even have a sense of where these cuts are coming down. Like, are, you know, is
which
it
schools will be
which
most
schools
affected?
Is it the west side, is it the south side, is it the north side?
What has CTU said about these, what are now classroom cuts, if we're talking about teachers and aides and things? Like, the district typically tries to avoid making cuts that will impact the classroom. These are going to hit hard.
They are going to hit hard. And, you know, not just CTU, I mean, everybody is upset, and they really want for the state to come in and to Rufus is like,
they're always, always asking the state for,
well,
to,
I mean, they
to
say the state, the state
what
only,
they believe to be
right,
its part.
Only about 73% of what the state has declared is an adequate education is the state giving this the city of Chicago. But, you know, there's a lot of other levels too where there's money that is owed to CPS, that, you know, whether it's Cook County, the state, there's some city money that, you know, that they would like to have to fill some of the budget.
And some of the district's critics are also like, how are you spending this money? The number of children you have has shrunk. You still have the same number of buildings, as Rufus was saying before we got started, as well as just the budget has ballooned compared to back when the student body was actually much bigger.
Yeah. Can I say something too, though? I wrote a story last week that was talking about special education and how the number of kids in special education has actually increased. Well, the number of students in the city in CPS overall has decreased, and their needs have increased. There's many more students who have autism, many more students with significant medical delays and developmental delays, and this is costing CPS a lot of
those
money.
The amount of money for and to educate.
CPS has doubled the amount of money that they're spending on special education in the last 6 years, doubled it, and the state and federal government's money has stayed pretty static. CPS is spending $1.3 billion on special education out of tax, our own local taxpayer money now.
Expect for a long time we're going to be talking about the schools, because we've got so much turmoil with the things that you just pointed out, with the changes in governance, with a relatively new CEO. She just came in to be permanent.
Less than a year.
So there's a lot of turmoil that's going on. So we should expect to be talking about this.
This is often the case for CPS, actually. Monica, I don't want to give this one the short shrift, but briefly, Chicago man Daniel Aguirre faces a dozen felony charges after an alleged standoff earlier this week left a woman and a SWAT officer injured. What happened there?
It seemed like there was a domestic altercation with his wife and his 14-year-old daughter, where he was they were screaming because he was beating them. The mother-in-law, his mother-in-law, came upstairs, said, "What's going on?" He shot at the door, went through the door, shot the mother-in-law in the face. Finally, a SWAT team came in, tried to knock down the door. He shot at the SWAT team. It hit one of the SWAT officers, and they finally were able to get the mother and daughter out somewhat safely. But it just a horrible, horrible event.
Yeah, heartbreaking situation. Melody, the Shedd Aquarium welcomed four rescued beluga whales. The plan is to take in six more. What's the story there?
Yeah, so Marineland, which is located in Canada, is a shuttered, basically, aquarium, marine park that has had 30 stranded beluga whales for quite some time now. And the owner of the park has said, hey, if the government of Canada is not going to let me export these whales to a country that is of approval, then I'm going to euthanize them. So the government of Canada reached out to a bunch of certified aquariums. Shedd Aquarium was one of them. And as a result, we are slowly starting to get some of these beluga whales. We're going to get up to 10 of them. The four of them that arrived are all female, and they're all live in a mini pod, which basically means they're all bonded,
they're bonded.
And they're friends. months. Right. So they're starting to adjust now to their new life at the shed, and we'll see more as some of them start to arrive.
Whales aren't small. They've got room for 10 extra whales.
They're huge. Exactly. They're huge. Well, I believe it's like somewhat of 3 million gallon tank, and it's ginormous with it's huge. If you've ever seen it at the shed, it looks smaller in person.
Space.
There's spaces that we don't see that
they're
able to go
to. And their pools are deep. Yes. Okay.
Yes.
Well, hopefully the shed will let us know when we can get a look at the new whales.
Oh, yeah.
That is our Week in Review panel. Thank you so much. We're out of time, but thanks to Monica Ng and Sarah Karp, as well as Rufus Williams and Melody Mercado. And we're back to wrap things up right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
And that's our show for this Friday night. Are you heading to the movie theater this weekend? Maybe you're going to catch the summer blockbuster, The Odyssey. Well, check out our Instagram at WTTW Chicago before you do to learn more about the hype around the film's format. Now for the Week in Review, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy, stay safe, and informed. Have a great weekend, everybody. Okay, so also in Chicago this weekend, WNBA All-Star Weekend is happening.
Yes.
Is anybody like catching anything or
Absolutely.
Going?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm planning to go to the game tomorrow.
Awesome.
And also, you know, the Gospel Fest is this weekend.
Yeah, that's
okay.
Yeah.
That's happening too.
This is the weekend to be in Chicago.
It is.
Every weekend
in the summer is the weekend to be in Chicago.
Savannah Bananas.
Savannah Bananas are happening this weekend too. I feel like I miss all of the good stuff. I have no good excuse.
You have little kids.
Exactly.
No, that's my good excuse.
That's
the reason to be out there.
Yeah, my kids aren't going to that.
Parking was $120.
See, let's start right there. Parking was $120.
For Savannah Bananas.
For the Savannah Bananas.
People like, hey, go to my garage type of thing.
Yeah.
Where were they playing?
Crazy.
Wrigley.
Oh. Yeah, they're playing it at Wrigley this year. Because I think when they came last summer, I think they were at Guaranteed Rate. Yeah.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm working to preserve the dignity and rights of all individuals.